So let me start by first saying that the bar is pretty high for me as I come and stand before you to share with you my thoughts, because you heard an extraordinary talk yesterday from Mike, from my colleague and friend of many years, Mike Girardi. And then you heard Steve Stack speak yesterday from his heart. And so I want to speak from my heart, too. I'm going to get out a little bit outside of my comfort zone, because I usually don't have prepared remarks or a text to read from, but there are a lot of things that I want to talk with you about. And so I do have some words that I'm occasionally going to refer to here, so forgive me if I look down at what I've written so far. First off, I want you to know that I feel really blessed. I feel blessed because I have great work, and I feel blessed because I have a great family. My family's here in the back of the room. I'm going to ask him to stand. It embarrasses him a little bit, but I have three beautiful daughters. I have one extraordinary wife of 31 years, Mia, Chelsea, Julia, and my wife, Amber. Would you stand, please, back there? So I love you all, and I'm really honored that you're here to hear me talk to the council today. And I want you to know that you all are my friends. And I mean that from way down deep. And I don't know how many of you saw the movie I Love You, Man, but I want you to know that. I love you, man. I love you, women. You're my friends, and you're my heroes, because you give your care and compassion every day to many people who have nowhere else to turn. You are my professional family. And I honor you for your commitment, and I want you to know that I'm dedicating this next year to making things better for you. See, I'm one of you. I'm a practicing emergency physician working in a community hospital trauma center that sees 38,000 patients a year in a underbedded 18-bed, mostly curtain and stretchered emergency departments. I still work my share of nights and weekends. I still live and breathe what you live and breathe. I know your frustrations and aggravations. I also know your joys on the occasional day when everything seems to come together and where you think to yourself, so this is why I went into emergency medicine. I want more of those days for you. Now, ACEP exists for its members. At the national level, we have to deal with the issues that Michael talked about yesterday, fair payment and liability reform and GME and quality issues. And at the same time, ACEP is also a local organization, and so we need to address the issues at the state level, as we debated and talked about a little bit today. Over 50% of emergency physicians report burnout, and you need to know that we have your back and that we're at your side. We need to walk as much in your halls of your legislatures as we need to walk in the halls of Congress. We will do that. I'm committed that by the end of the year, every single state chapter, every single chapter, including government relations, okay, will have received a leader or a board member visit within the past 3 years. And that's something that we have not accomplished in a very long time. When I first began practicing emergency medicine, we were an emergency room. And then we were the window to the community. And then we became an emergency department, and we became the door to the hospital. And we admit some places up to 80% of the patients. I think the average is about 65% of the patients get admitted to the hospitals now come through our doors. So we're the door to the hospital, but I think we have to adapt again. I think we have to change, and you've heard the phrase. I think we need to become the porch of the medical neighborhood. Let me make one thing clear. We are the patient-centered medical home for the medically homeless. In fact, we are the patient-centered medical home for most patients who become acutely ill and injured, and certainly for all of those after 5 p.m. and on weekends. So I want to, if possible, let's stop talking about the PCMH or the patient-centered medical home as if it's a primary care concept or a notion that's foreign to us. Let's just accept that we are it. And let's get recognition for that. We work with cardiologists, endocrinologists, nephrologists, hospitalists. You know what I think we are? I think we are availabilists. We give people what they want when they want it. In fact, probably we give people really what they need when they need it. We should be proud of that, and we should be recognized for that. Now what, indeed. What brought us to this dance is not going to get us into the next one. I often say these days that the future is ahead of schedule. We are in a time of disruptive innovation, and in fact, our LAC, Leadership and Advocacy Conference next year, that's going to be the first theme, disruptive innovation, and what can we do about it? How can we stay ahead of the curve? We have retail clinics, we have telehealth, and they are, in fact, changing the landscape. And we may well see a decrease in the less ill patients who come to us. If you look at what Americans want, if you're over 65, what do you want? You want a doctor you can trust, and you want quality. But if you're under 65 in the United States, what do you want? You want access, convenience, and cost. And as much as people try to shift people out of the emergency department, they still come streaming into us. And why do they still come streaming into us? Because you are you. You give, you care, and you are there for them. Now let me do some simple math for you. Simple math equation, X divided by Y equals Z. If X is healthcare dollars, and Y is the number of people dividing up those dollars, then Z becomes the number of dollars per patient. If X stays roughly about the same, and Z increases dramatically, as we know it will, with 10,000 Americans every day turning 65 today and for the next 16 years, then Z will decrease dramatically. There is no way getting around that math. And so we have to get ready for getting paid less for every time we see a patient. For the same care that we give now, we're going to be paid less. What does that mean for us? It means we're going to have to continue to see more patients. It means we're going to have to see them more efficiently. It means that our advanced practice providers, our PAs and our nurse practitioners are going to have a bright future in terms of the care that we give. We will have to leverage our time, and we will have to do more with less. Now, I don't think we have to worry about numbers, because I think with the incidence of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, we will see plenty of patients. But our job is going to get more difficult, unless, of course, unless we can rebrand what we do and work with our hospital partners to decrease the cost of an emergency department visit. And you know as well as I do that over 75% of the cost of an emergency department visit is a hospital charge. We have to go to our hospital partners and we have to say to them, would you please stop cost shifting overhead from other parts of the hospital onto the backs of our patients? Our patients deserve better. Now people say, but your emergency department is already overrun with patients. How do you expect to see more? And I'm going to tell you, I think our hospitals have to be more efficient. We have only so much room, we have only so much resources. Decision to admit to patient departure should be an hour or less. How many people feel that way? Wouldn't that be patient-centered care? I think it would be. It's well documented that the boarding of inpatients leads to increased sentinel events, decreased clinical outcomes, decreased patient satisfaction. That's well documented. And it sucks. Space and personal assets from us so that we don't have the resources that we need to take care of the patients who are streaming in, even after we've made our diagnosis. And let me make one thing real clear. You know, healthcare is a team sport, right? We can't do anything without our nurse colleagues. And if you look at one of the single biggest issues that we have in terms of recruiting and retaining the best and brightest nurses, it's how much are we taking care of inpatients who are boarded in our emergency department. Because they didn't go into emergency nursing to take care of inpatients. They went into emergency nursing for the same reason that you did. It's because we're adrenaline junkies and we like to play Sherlock Holmes and we like to figure out what's going on with our patients and make them better on the spot. So I think that what we have to do is we have to ask our hospital colleagues to do the same thing that you and I do. In the same way that we have our ER throughput dashboard, and we look at patient arrival to triage, and triage to bed, and bed to physician, or bed to provider, and then decision to admit to patient departure, we need to ask our hospitalist colleagues and our hospital leaders to create an inpatient throughput dashboard. What percentage of patients are discharged by 10 a.m.? From the time of discharge, how long does it take for the patient to actually leave? From the time they actually leave, how long does it take to get the bed clean? From the time the bed is clean, how long does it take to get the next patient in the bed? We need to ask them for that. Here's the rub. They don't know how to do that. So I'm going to tell you that one of the things that we're committing to this year, Michael was extraordinary in terms of focusing on psychiatric boarding. We're going to focus on the bigger issue of boarding now. We're going to relook at our 2008 task force report and the paper that we put together on boarding. We're going to update it, and we're going to create an actual toolbox that you will be able to take to your hospital leaders and say, here are some things that work, here's the data that shows they work, and here's how we can work with you to make that happen. Now, make no mistake, the driver of healthcare reform is not quality, it's cost. We'll need to show our value to our patients, to the federal government, and we'll need to show our value to our insurers. If you're in a group of 15 physicians, you're going to have to strongly consider, are we still going to allow 15 different my ways, or can we come up with one our way? Because it's no longer going to be acceptable to have what I saw when I visited an emergency department now about 3 weeks ago, where the chair of radiology said to me, what sort of, about how many CAT scans should be ordered in this 40,000 volume emergency department that admits 25% of their patients? And so thank you, Jim Augustine. I went to the ED Benchmarking Alliance data, and I found that it should be around 24%. And I said, well, so what are your numbers? And he said, well, we have some doctors that order CAT scans on 18% of patients, and we have some doctors that order CAT scans on 42% of patients. Is that okay? So I ask you, is that okay? Are we going to be able to allow that kind of variation? Now, you heard yesterday from Michael about the $3 million grant that we got from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And that's very special for us. This project that will be led by Drs. Jay Scher and Arjun Venkatesh, it's going to help us demonstrate the incredible importance of what we do, and it's going to help us do it better. But it's not a project that they can just lead. It's a project that we're going to have to do. If you look at the data, if you look at what their projections are, they intend to work with over 2,000 emergency departments in the next several years. And put that in conjunction with what you heard about our clinical emergency data registry and our issues with regard to care coordination. There's a lot of really exciting stuff to do. We're going to have to recognize that same old is not in our future. Now, you heard that in the past year, we created our qualified clinical data registry. Let me give you some data on those metrics. The projection is that by 2020, 70% of healthcare data will be transparent. By 2025, it's going to be 100%. 65% of people right now are aware of physician rating sites. 59% consider them either somewhat important or very important. 35% of people have chosen a doctor based upon a positive rating. 37% have avoided a physician based upon a negative rating. Right now, with regard to the hospital, 25% of their metrics, of their quality metrics, of their value modifier, is related to the patient experience. And with regard to physicians and outpatient physicians in what's called clinician and group CAPS, that's the outpatient patient experience survey, physicians either have to report 9 quality metrics or they report 6 quality metrics plus CG CAPS. So that makes it 1/3 of the metrics. So let me tell you what my goal is this year. My goal is this year, and you heard a little bit about that before, my goal is this year, through CDER, through our clinical data registry, is to validate patient experience metrics, which we ourselves can choose, so that we are less reliant on the CMS patient experience of care survey, which will be administered by those same survey companies that believe that 100 surveys a quarter provides valid and benchmarkable information. Now, what do we as physicians want? What do we want? I like acronyms. I think we want CARE, C-A-R-E. I think we want care quality for our patients first and foremost. That's why we became doctors. I think it's nice if we get a little bit of appreciation for what we want, for what we do. I think it's nice if there can be responsiveness to our issues and we have some input. And I think efficiency of our practice is very important. We have to work and continue to work and work very hard with the enterprise health information systems to make your life easier. We also have to work with the best of breeds that are still around. Let me share with you that in my ED, we went to CPOE last April. We lost a half of our experienced nursing staff and a quarter of our productivity. And that's not fair. That's not fair to our patients, and that's not fair to us. Because at the end of my day now, and Steve talked about this yesterday, I find myself working harder, okay, seeing fewer patients and working harder and wondering, did I forget something and did I make a mistake? And did I tell the nurse what I wanted? Because now we no longer communicate face-to-face, we communicate through the electronic interface. And from my perspective, that's a real safety issue and we have to do something about that. Thank you. Now, I'd also like ASAP, and this is kind of an innovative concept. How would you feel about telling our patients when they walk into the emergency department, here's a downloadable app, and we'd like you to download this app because this is going to give you the opportunity to give us some feedback, some information back in terms of your clinical outcomes in the next week, and in terms of an immediate feedback in terms of your experience of care. And I would like to see that, because one of the things that has really hampered us has been our inability to provide clinical outcome data for the patients that we treat and release. Not go we get it with regard to the patients that we treat and admit, but the patients that we treat and release, we get very little data unless you're doing follow-up phone calls or unless the patient has an adverse outcome. See, we are scapegoated as the most expensive place to receive care, but if you actually look at the numbers, here's what you find. We make a diagnosis in 3 hours instead of in 3 days or 3 weeks. You can't compare the cost of an emergency department visit to just the cost of a primary care doctor's office, because they then send the patient to lab and to imaging, and those aren't included when they compare our cost to that of the primary care doctor's office. And if you then look at the fact that we save the patient 3 or 4 days of being out of work or even longer, then the truth is we become the most cost-effective place for patients to receive care, and we need to be recognized for that as well. Now, you've heard talk about fair payment. I want to shift that a little bit, because I want to talk about fair coverage for our patients, not just fair payment for us, because the two go hand in hand. And being candid, I'm sick and tired of having the insurance companies pigeonhole us as physicians and make us the bad guys, when in fact, here's what they do. They say to patients, you can pay less if you go for a high deductible, and then they offer to pay us, I mean, they drive down what they pay us and make us go out of network. And then instead of admitting that they are paying less and covering patients less, they say that we are charging too much. Now, I want to give you a word of caution, and this came up a little bit in the council in the discussion that we just had with the council. Because for now, we have solutions at the state level. But what I'm seeing as I look overall around the United States is I'm seeing that the whole issue of out of network and balance billing, that's an issue which we're going to see, I suspect, in more and more states. And it may be that we are going to have to craft, we're not there yet, but it may be that we're going to have to craft in the next few years a specialty approach and an organizational approach to this issue. Because I don't think that we can craft 50 different solutions for 50 different states. I think we're going to have to look at it. And some of us, we may have to say, we need to compromise and give up a little bit of what has made us successful and brought us profit in the past to guarantee our success in the future. My privilege, it's my honor to be your president. I want to tell you that I'm astonished by the depth of your intelligence and by the commitment you have to your patients and to our specialty. Whether you're working at the chapter level, whether you're hosting a legislator in your ER, whether you're being part of the 911 network, thank you, Andy Byrne, for doing the triple E. Now, whether you're defending the prudent layperson definition of an emergency. Ferdinand Foch, French Allied Supreme Commander from World War I, who helped the French defeat the Germans against all odds. Here's what he said. He said, the greatest force on earth is the human soul on fire. And you, my colleagues, you're all fire starters. You're the best. You give, you care, you're there for your patients, and you're there for us as ASAP. I want you to know that your ASAP board has worked tirelessly on your behalf. So that you know, they give up anywhere from 3 to 4 up to 10 days a month to do the business of the college and to support you both on the national and on the local level, and for little compensation. Why do we do it? We do it because we believe in our specialty and we believe in you. And I'm going to tell you, we want you to believe in us, and we want you to know that we're on your side. You, the council, you've been magnificent in choosing board members with different levels of expertise, and they've represented you brilliantly. Whether it be at the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma, where they were about to limit the ability of some of our legacy colleagues to be able to work in trauma centers, or whether it be with CMS and anesthesia, where they wanted to limit our ability to use drugs that we use a lot, like propofol and ketamine. And your board members have represented you well. I also want you to know that we have the best staff that any specialty society could ever want. Dean Wilkerson has, yes, thank you. We do. Dean Wilkerson has done and continues to do an outstanding job as our executive director. You don't know how lucky you are. I look around, I see other specialty societies who are struggling with their executive leadership. We're really lucky. Hold your applause for a second, because I'm going to ask you, because I got to mention some other people. Sonia Montgomery as our Governance Operations Director, Carol Willard, Dean's Executive Assistant, Mary Ellen Fletcher, our Leadership Administrative Coordinator, all support the board and the council in an extraordinary way to optimize how we do our business. Dean has assembled an outstanding group of individuals who accomplish all of the work you and we ask of them. I could list every one of them. I believe that they all love ASAP and believe in you, and they share our commitment to service. So right now, what I'd like to ask is all of the ASAP staff who are here, ASAP staff, Dean, I'd like you to stand up, and I'd like us to give them a rousing applause. Thank you. Now, you heard Steve Stack yesterday. Gosh, what a gifted leader. What a gifted leader. And if you're not members of the AMA, I hope that you'll sign up while you're here in Boston. It's really easy to do. It's easy to do online. And I really look forward to working closely with Steve over the next year and with John Becker, president of the AOA. Tell you, the House of Medicine stands much stronger with emergency physicians contributing to its leadership and its guidance. As long as I'm talking about outstanding leadership, I have to talk about EMRA. And y'all were very supportive of EMRA, and I'm thrilled. Our young physicians and candidate members are the future of our specialty. Now, your board has made a concerted effort to visit the residency programs. And we are targeting every program, every emergency medicine residency program that's not had an ASAP leader in the past 3 years for a visit this year. And if yours has not, then you need to contact us, because we're going to get somebody there. We have to create additional educational guidance, leadership training, and mentoring opportunities that assure that our pipeline of future leaders is filled. ASAP 15, the ED Directors Academy, the Teaching Fellowship, EMBERS, the EMBERS Workshop, and the Leadership and Advocacy Conference all provide really extraordinary educational opportunities on site. Our education committee and our staff deserve special recognition. ECME, if you haven't experienced it, is astoundingly easy to access and offers extraordinary education. Now, finally, I want to focus on our wellness. You know, most of you know that that's something that's been important to me for a long time. Burnout and compassion are endemic, or probably I should say epidemic, in our specialty. How do you characterize burnout? It's loss of fulfillment at work. It's emotional exhaustion. It's depersonalization, a sense that we've lost our way and we have no control of our environment. Then there's a definition of a burnout is the chronic condition of perceived demands outweighing perceived resources. So let me ask this. How often are you working short in terms of nursing and technical staff? How often are we boarding inpatients who would rather be upstairs in comfortable beds than in our ERs? And these days, how often are you working more shifts than you'd actually want to work because you don't have the docs and the advanced practice providers that you need to work the number of shifts that you want? So let me tell you what we're going to do. This year, we're going to focus on emergency physician and emergency caregiver wellness and resilience. January 24th to 30th will be the first, hopefully annual, emergency ASAP, Emergency Physician Wellness Week. I have to tell you that we've already heard interest from ENA and interest from SAEM to also participate in that. We'll have several exciting activities planned. We hope to have ASAP members sign a pledge and select items off of a menu of resolutions for the week. The resolutions will include the usual suspects like healthier eating and exercise and diet and getting enough sleep, but we'll also incorporate connecting with family and friends, creating a gratitude letter, a visit to someone who's made a big difference to you in your life, and doing something for your career. There's so much going on in our world which doesn't make sense. We have political parties in disarray, unable to produce candidates for president who are trusted and acknowledged to be true leaders. We have senseless violence like what transpired in Roseburg, Oregon, where my partners took care of those patients who were brought in from the community college shooting. We have insurance companies now merging together to be mega companies, creating a virtual monopoly in the marketplace, and they entice patients to buy high deductible plans and then refuse to pay physicians and hospitals for the care that are given. And we know how important physician and patient communication is to creating trust and clinical outcomes in our patients. And yet we have patient satisfaction survey companies who profess and assure our hospital CEOs that by surveying 100 patients in 3 months, they can arrive at a statistically valid patient satisfaction score. This does not meet the credibility threshold. Here's what does make sense. Here's what makes sense. You do. You're on the front lines every day, doing the best you can with the resources you're given to give high-quality, compassionate care to your patients. You have to shape-shift constantly. Like I did on my last clinical shift, one of my last clinical shifts, where I walk in, stretcher 7, see a 43-year-old guy who's feeling lightheaded and weak and thinks he's having a stroke. And the reason is that 5 days earlier, at age 43, with 2 kids, age 4 and 8, he's told that he has a 5.1 centimeter rectal carcinoma. And then I have to run directly from that to stretcher 3, where I have to see a 3-year-old who drowned in a bathtub and attempt to resuscitate this 3-year-old, and I can still feel the easy IO as I was putting it in the kid's tibia, and dealing with the mother's grief. And then I have to go directly from that to a full trauma that comes in, a motorcyclist who hits an embankment, goes over his handlebars, and ends up coming in paralyzed from the neck down. Not only do I have to take care of him, now I have to talk to his wife, who previously had a completely functional husband, and I now have to break that to her. Been there? Done that? Of course you have. There's no stopping. There is no stopping. You give, you care, you are there 24/7, 365. I honor you for that. Now, there's a lot going on. We could feel attacked from all sides. Not I or your board, however, are playing victim here. If this is the hand we're dealt, we're going to play it. I'm a glass half full person. I've never seen anyone get what they want by feeling powerless. we will see every obstacle as a stepping stone. Instead of getting frustrated, we will get fascinated and see what we can learn and how we can alter the future course. And I want to leave you with one quote from a great artist, from Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo da Vinci, who said, "It had long since come to my attention that people of accomplishment rarely sat back and let things happen to them. They went out and happened to things." So my friends, my colleagues, come with me and let's go out and happen to things. Thank you very much. Now, thank you very much. I know we want to get to the elections, but I have a little bit of business to take care of first. It's my privilege to invite my friend and colleague, Mike Girardi, up. And let me say one thing as he's making his way up here. I could not have asked for a better president to follow in the footsteps of. And to have Alex Rosenau as the past president, Michael as the president, and during the year that I'm president-elect, it has been true joy for me. And you probably don't know this, but I hired Michael out of the military. I was his first boss out of the military. And so it's been extraordinary for me to see how he's grown over the years, what a leader he's become, and how I can learn from him. So Michael, come up. And I have an award with a gavel here. It's a President Award to Michael J. Girardi, MD, FACEP, for your outstanding contribution and dedication to the members of ASEP.